Welcome. For those of you who are just joining us, this is the third in our series of four seminars in June. The first two were on Catholics and Protestants, and we do that for a lot of reasons, but not least because a significant percentage of the people of Westminster come from Catholic backgrounds. So we spent 2 weeks talking about that. Now we zoom out a couple clicks from what's called ecumenical relations, that's within Christian denominations, among Christian denominations, to interfaith discussion. Today about Christians and Jews in the 21st century, next week about Christians and Muslims. So that's our plan. This is third of four. We'll take a week off for 4th of July weekend, and then the Peace and Justice team will have a series of presentations with guests on social concerns from a Roman Catholic, Jewish, and Muslim perspective. So that's what's coming. Glad you're here. Bobby has show and tell. Do you need a microphone? If I stay close to you.
This is it. Hello. I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can walk and chew gum at the same time here. Anyway, Jim has given you a heads up about what's coming in July. There'll be three Sundays in July, and they will address the social justice focus of the three major religion, three Abrahamic religions, Christianity, in particular Catholicism, Judaism, and Islam. And we have guests who are people of each of those faiths who will talk about their particular involvement and some of the issues related to that. We look forward to you coming. It will be in this same space and same time. And I have a little reminder for you to stick in a book to so that you remember when it is and what's going on. Thank you.
Thanks, Bobby. And as always, invite somebody to come along. We've had some people who are just interested in the seminar topic, so if you know of anybody in your community, invite them to come. Okay. As always, let's begin with a prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for, again, this beautiful season, for this time of new life springing up around us in nature and also little ones that join our community. And as our theme today tells us this morning, we are the big people responsible for caring for your creation and for these little ones. And so we ask that you would guide us in all things and especially in this hour, as we consider relations with your people called out in Abraham and Moses and David and the tradition of the prophets. So God, we come from them, and the message that we share grew out of the message, the covenant that you have with them. So help us open our hearts and minds to understand, and help us to be sisters and brothers with your people everywhere in ways that acknowledge differences, but share the truth in love. So we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. You probably know, or you may have heard in the news last week or two, this is the 50th anniversary this month of the Six-Day War. In June of 1967, Israel fought a war against Egypt and Jordan, Syria, struck just as it appeared that the Arab nations around the relatively new country of Israel were gathering in threatening ways. They were prepared for a long and disastrous struggle, and to everyone's astonishment, the war only lasted 6 days. And not surprisingly, when people of faith venture out on something scary and it goes well, people often take that as a sign of God's favor. So that's 50 years ago this month, actually. And in some ways, I think that's not a bad place to start because it's a kind of symbol of Jewish situation today, which is to say a strong people, a strong nation in Israel, still here in spite of lots of conflicts and struggles, but always aware of facing existential threats in a way that most of us here don't face at all. Population estimates are always hard. By the way, I made a mistake last week. I just want to clarify, because I never want to lie to you. And if I find that I made a mistake, I want to correct it. So last week, just clearing this up, last week I said there are 1.6 million Presbyterians, and that was about the number of Mormons. I realized as I was saying it that was confused. 1.6% of the population are Mormons. There are 1.6 million Presbyterians, which means there are about a third as many of us as there are of Mormons. Just to clarify that, I was having a synaptic cross, sometimes called a senior moment, I guess. So I just want to clarify that. But anyway, so population estimates, even when you get them right, are often hard. But in round numbers, there are about 6 million Jews in Israel, about 6 million, maybe slightly more, in the United States, maybe 15 or 16 million around the world, which is to say, among other things, that the United States has a peculiar relationship with Israel for lots of reasons, but not least because there are at least as many Jews in America as there are in Israel. I was going to say a few things and then tee up conversation. So, major concerns of the Jewish community. I'm going to sketch out three briefly. You might want to raise others. First one, most conspicuous, of course, is anti-Semitism, and we all have some sense of that. Historic phenomenon among many countries. It erupts and spikes again episodically in the United States, and people who track these things have pointed out that the number of hate groups in this country spiked dramatically when Obama became president. It's continued to be high. Jews are often objects of those kinds of eruptions. So anti-Semitism in this country and around the world, a huge, huge issue for Jewish people. We started our Jewish-Christian dialogue. I lose track of time. I have no temporal depth perception. So 4 or 5 years ago, we started our Jewish-Christian dialogue in the South Hills, and we started rotating among houses of worship because we didn't want people to be afraid that it was going to be sort of co-opted by any particular group. So we were going around to synagogues and churches and so forth, and we went to Bethel, Congregation Bethel, the conservative synagogue above Wendy's is how Alex Greenbaum, or not, no, above Taco Bell is how Alex Greenbaum describes it because he's a fan of Taco Bell. Anyway, we went there to go to the dialogue, and I went to go in, and the doors were all locked. So we got inside, and by now we're all friends. I said, "What the heck, Alex? You invite us to your church, or to your synagogue, to have a discussion, and you lock the doors. What's up with that?" And he said, "We always lock our doors. Because," and I was out of Pittsburgh when this happened, but many of you were here. Some years ago, somebody went around to various locations shooting Jews. And you start to talk to people about that, and you say, "Oh my goodness, these are people that I now think of as friends. We're just getting together to talk about how we understand God. And you guys need to keep your doors locked because in the last few years, somebody has come around to harm you just because of who you are." That was a striking thing to me. Not that I didn't understand that anti-Semitism is a problem, but we couldn't even get in the synagogue for a meeting until they came to open it because we can't afford to leave the doors open. So, anti-Semitism, a huge issue. Of course, we all know about the Holocaust, and behind that, a history of crusades, inquisitions, expulsion from whole countries like Spain in the early modern period. So, anti-Semitism, a huge concern. Second, and related to that, the security of the State of Israel. From the get-go, when Israel was formed, many of the surrounding Arab nations declared that it was not a legitimate state. And, depending on what accounts you read, something on the order of 600,000 or 700,000 Palestinians left within a few years. Israelis tend to describe that as a voluntary emigration. Palestinians tend to describe that as what they call the Nakba, the catastrophe. So very different interpretations of history. But from the get-go, the Jewish state was founded in a rather tenuous way. We could talk about the history of that if you want to. You probably already know it. But related to the rise of anti-Semitism, of course, is concern for the integrity of the Jewish state. And that's obviously in the wake of the Holocaust of World War II, the Palestinian conflict within the land of Israel and Palestine, and the continual threat of Arab nations around Israel, and the president of Iran, not the current one, but the most recent one, Ahmadinejad, openly declaring that he wanted to obliterate the state of Israel, to annihilate the Jews, and, excuse me, I just got a bug today, and developing nuclear weapons. with the explicit claim that he was going to try to wipe out the Jews. Sorry, here. So concerned about the security of Israel, externally vis-a-vis Iran and some of the Arab nations, and y'all know that the Iranians are not Arabs, they're Persians by background, different ethnic group, different language. And within the land of Israel-Palestine conflict between the Palestinian peoples, trying to figure out is there going to be a two-state solution or not, we can talk about all of that. So anti-Semitism, number one, the security of the state of Israel, number two, and number three, a little more subtle but nonetheless real in this country, the fear of assimilation. And that's to say, lots of Jews marry Gentiles. And the fear is that Judaism in this country will eventually dissipate through interfaith marriage. So many rabbis will not perform interfaith marriages. I've done a couple myself with rabbis who were willing to do this, but many will not. Not out of any animosity towards Christians, but just because of feeling the need to preserve the Jewish community and identity in the face of historic and current existential threats. So, all that to say, the Jewish community in this country has been engaged in cautious but sincere conversation, dialogue, engagement with Christians for a long time, certainly at least since World War II. Will Herberg, Jewish sociologist, wrote a book called Protestant Catholic Jew in 1955, wherein he argued, now this is the Eisenhower era, and Eisenhower famously said it's important that people should be of some religion, I don't care what it is. People said, huh? He was Presbyterian, by the way, so I don't know. That's a coincidence, maybe. A lot of people claim to be Presbyterian, but I digress. moving on. And so, right in the middle of the Eisenhower administration, when, by the way, John Foster Dulles, a prominent Presbyterian layman, international lawyer, was Secretary of State, Will Herberg, a Jewish sociologist, wrote a book called Protestant Catholic Jew, the thesis of which was that now, in 1955, it's okay in America to belong to any of these traditions. And part of the big deal about the book was Jews had kind of won their place. First Protestants, of course, we were a WASPy nation in the founding, except for Maryland mostly, which was largely Catholic. Then in the 19th century, early 20th century, Catholics sort of gained a foothold and then gradually received acceptance. John Kennedy officially, you know, the first Catholic president, still controversial. But 5 years before that, excuse me, Will Herberg could say, the country was founded mostly by Protestants. Catholics have pretty well been established. And now we Jews, this side of World War II, are acknowledged as legitimate Americans as well. So this sort of cautious engagement, the sense that, well, we belong here too, at least as old as 1955, and the Jews have been involved in formal dialogues with the Roman Catholic Church, with various Protestant denominations. I myself, as some of you know, attend every year. I've been 11 years, all 11 of these. If it was Sunday school, I'd have the perfect attendance bars all the way down. I've been to all 11 of the Council on Foreign Relations workshops on religion and international affairs. And among the people that go to those, David Saperstein, one of the leading Jewish advocates in the nation, lots of rabbis from all over the place, as well as Muslims and Christians of various flavors, Buddhists, Hindus, and so forth. So I see these folks every year. And at the national and international level, there's dialogue. Our own South Hills dialogue here decided not to keep moving around to various synagogues and churches because nobody could remember where it was this month. But also because, after a couple years of meeting, people were comfortable. one of the rabbis said to me in the first year or so, you know, it's hard to get Jews to trust showing up in a church. But by about the third year, they said, you know what, we're happy to host at Westminster. If you don't mind coming here, at least people will know where to go. And so for the last 3 years, we've been here. But that's no small thing. Because our Jewish friends finally decided, yeah, we can trust these Westminster folk. And so now we have a dialogue every month from September, October, depending on when the Jewish holidays fall, to May. And it's about anywhere from 35 to 50, roughly one-third Westminster folk, because we're the home team and people show up. And we have people that care about this. Roughly one-third Jews and roughly one-third miscellaneous other Christians. We're always trying to get more Christians of other flavors to come. So lots of dialogue at the national level, the international level, local level between Jews and Christians. Let me say a word about my personal experience, and then we'll just talk. For no planned reason, but just sort of providentially, it turns out that Jewish people have been among the most prominent influences in my life. A couple weeks ago, my wife and I, Gwen and I, went down to visit my 92-year-old high school English teacher and debate coach, Ruth Schrag, in Manassas. When I was about 16, Ruth Schrag was my favorite person in the world. It was that sort of adolescent time when your own parents don't look so good to you. Talk about that in the sermon. And here was this Jewish woman who was my English teacher, which would not have been such a big deal, except that she was also our debate coach. And she herself had been a national champion debater. And so our little Charleroi debate team, she put together, started. I was one of the early participants in it. And my two Jewish debate partners, the older sister and I, won the state championship, and the younger brother and I went to nationals. And this was all because Ruth Schrag taught us how to get up and talk in front of people, and how to think clearly, and how to reason on our feet. When I was, I can't remember, I think I was just starting in college, I went to preach, and I was in a Methodist in those days, went to preach in a little Methodist church in Manassas, and she showed up. And one of the ushers, an old guy, came up to me. I was 19 years old or something. It was my first sermon, not in my little home church in Belle Vernon. This older usher guy came up to me and said, "There's a Jewish girl here." This Jewish girl was probably 48 years old. And I said, "It's okay, she's with me." But here, this sort of generosity, this wonderful, smart, funny woman who took an interest in us young people, Jews and Goyim, taught us how to speak. And, of course, the irony was not lost on her that one of these guys that she taught how to speak and won a state championship and went to the nationals turned out to be a Christian preacher, and that's partly her fault. But when I started to preach, showed up to hear me, right? And now, however many years that was later, I've stopped doing the math because I keep getting these big numbers and I just don't want to think about it. However many years ago it was that I was in high school, she's 92, we still stay in touch. And I was just telling somebody, I was telling Mary Lou a minute ago, she's reading my sermons. Gwen decided, well, let's just take Ruth a couple books of sermons. I said, really? So she's reading, my 92-year-old English teacher, debate coach, is reading sermons from here, and I will look forward to a critique when we go to see her again. So that was when I was in high school. That was formative. Then I went to college. I dated a Jewish girl for a while. Then I did my PhD at Carnegie Mellon, where my thesis was on, in history, my thesis was on ecumenical Protestant sort of missionaries and globalism after World War II. My advisors were two Jews and a Presbyterian elder. And the Jewish guy who was chair of my committee invited me back to teach at CMU, some of you know, this last year, the Introduction to Religion. He knows I'm a Presbyterian minister. But the sort of generosity that I've experienced from these Jewish people who have been mentors to me. The other Jewish mentor, some of you have met, Dan Resnick, used to come to our dialogue. He's getting on in years now and can't travel from the East End as well. Dan invited me to be part of a major national assessments and education program that I was running around the country with for 2 years, with his wife as my boss and another Jewish guy. So the point is, my personal experience has been these sort of wonderful, bright, generous, compassionate Jewish people at every stage of my life, creating opportunities for me, inviting me in, and they're my friends. And so this whole matter of Jewish-Christian dialogue isn't just a sort of intellectually interesting thing to me, although it is that. But these are my friends. These are some of the most influential people in my life. And since we've been doing the dialogue, Gwen and I have become good friends, like all the rabbis, but we've become good friends with Mark and Alice Mahler, and we've been to dinner several times and think of each other as good friends. But all of that is one in the context of this larger reality for Jewish people of living with this existential threat living with anti-Semitism that most of us could barely begin to understand how that feels, having to lock the synagogue so that somebody doesn't come in and shoot us up just because we're Jews, concerned about the state of Israel, and understanding the problems of the Palestinians, and feeling, at least the Jews that I talk to, feeling all the ambivalence of that. On the one hand, who should be more about justice for all people than the Jewish people who have the prophets Micah, Amos, Hosea as part of their heritage? Of course they get social justice, and Hamas keeps lobbing rockets into the state, and Netanyahu's building settlements. Several of us, who was on the trip? I can't tell just by looking. Four or five of us, six of us here out of the 12 went on the trip. We rode around, and you guys can talk about that. We rode around Israel and Palestine, and we saw the settlements popping up everywhere. And we saw the wall everywhere. And we were visiting Palestinian Christians whose life is really pretty miserable because of the wall and the settlements. And my Jewish friends get that. But also the security of Israel is an existential issue for them. So what to do about that is an agonizing thing. In any case, for me, this is partly personal, partly sort of interesting as an intellectual and spiritual thing. I'll just say one more thing. part of what I've found in all of this is what I think I read in 1 Corinthians 13. We read 1 Corinthians 13 at weddings all the time, so-called love chapter. Love is patient and kind, etc., etc., etc. It tells you how to be good to this person you're about to marry. But the word love is agape, of course, and we've talked about that here. It means a love that wants what's best for the other. It's not based on reciprocity or attractiveness or desire. But also, Paul says, if I have all knowledge, if I have all faith so as to move mountains, if I know all the truth, if I have all my facts right, but have not love, I'm nothing. I'm a noisy gong, a clanging cymbal. And I invited Mark Mahler to come to be in my class at CMU once when we were talking about Judaism. He was a big hit. I'm very clear to say we disagree about some stuff, and some fairly important stuff, like who's Jesus? Well, to Christians, that's a fairly important thing, right? Jews would say, well, different Jews say different things. You know, nice young guy, a rabbi, maybe a proto-Pharisee himself, maybe certainly a proto-rabbi. Christians added this stuff about divinity. We don't believe that because he's a good Jewish boy. Jews have all kinds of views about Jesus, but what they emphatically don't believe is that Jesus is the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, and the Messiah. We do. That's a difference. And that's a major difference. But in our world, in which even smaller differences cause people to break out in food fights, and all sorts of hostility and enmity and bitterness and evil stuff like what happened in the baseball game practice this last week. In that kind of society, it's no trivial thing for a church like Westminster to reach out to a community as existentially concerned as the Jewish community is and build friendships, not just as some sort of project, but because we generally know and love each other and say, I can disagree with you about the central thing that I preach, Jesus Christ, Son of God. And still, I can love you as a friend because I believe that God loves all of us and wants us to get along. So, for all kinds of reasons, personal, academic, spiritual, theological, and social, because the church needs to be a place where people can see things differently and still relate to people in love and friendship, for all those reasons, our connection with the Jewish community is really important to me, and I'm delighted that so many people from Westminster support that. Many come to the dialogue, but I know many of the rest of you are supportive as well, even if you can't come. So let me stop, and we got a good half hour. Let's talk. Questions, comments, whatever you want to share. Carolyn.
Standing glass windows, and there are floodlights behind them, and watching a control shadow behind the windows. And that was very eye-opening, much as you said, what do you mean the doors are locked? Sit there and say, oh, you never think of that. So if you come to the Holocaust remembrance in the future, you probably won't see them, but the police are always there.
Yeah. Thank you. Others? Please, Bob.
When you opened with the mention of the war in 67, you were talking about the notion that God sort of smiled on this group or that kind of interpretation. Put me in mind of something that I think is unique in Judaism. I don't know that we have an analogy for it, since we're doing a little compare and contrast. There's this notion of mitzvah.
Okay, I think you're setting up some things that we want to be talking about too, so let's just run with that for a minute. Bob's mentioning the notion of the mitzvah, plural mitzvot. It means basically doing what you're commanded, and particularly in the form of a good deed. So if you talk to a Jewish person who did something nice, and say, "It was nice you did that," she'll say, "Oh, that was my mitzvah for the day." It just means doing what God commands in the form of a good deed of some sort. So I'm going to take that as an excuse to do a little riff on some of the images that Christians sometimes have of Jews that are not quite accurate. One is what you point to, and that is that doing good things is really important. There are 613 commandments, apparently. And the rabbis talk about that seriously, and the ones I know joke about it a little bit. But doing mitzvot, the plural, is central to being a good Jew. And so there is this sense that God expects us to be responsible and do good things in the community. And we need to remember that that's central to pretty much all Jewish teaching. Christians will often say stuff like, the Old Testament is a book of wrath and the New Testament is a book of love. The Old Testament, God's about wrath. The New Testament, God is about love. The Old Testament is about law. The New Testament's about grace. Well, no. First of all, when Jesus gives the love commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, love your neighbor as yourself, he didn't make that stuff up. He got it out of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, straight out of the Old Testament, number one. Number two, read the Old Testament, particularly the prophets, and you hear this tenderness in the voice of God, this grace, this willingness to forgive and start over. And yes, of course, there are laws, and yes, of course, you're supposed to be faithful and do your mitzvot. But fundamentally, it is the grace of God that saves the people. And as for wrath, yeah, there are problematic things in the Old Testament. The conquest of Canaan would be on the short list of hermeneutical challenges. Hermeneutics being the science of interpreting texts. And the Richard Dawkins of the world, who want to say how stupid religion is, will point to things like the book of Joshua, Judges, where it is attributed to God to effectively commit genocide. Scorched earth command comes right from God. Wipe them all out, their women and their children. Destroy their animals and their crops. Leave nothing standing. Burn over the country. That is attributed explicitly to God. So, in about year 5 of the dialogue, I said to the rabbi, so what about that? And some of them have interesting sort of exegetical twists with that. Some of them just say, I don't know, we skip over that. Which is a technique I recognize, by the way. Jews are not the only ones to do that. But the point is, this sort of Christian stereotype that the Old Testament is about wrath, the New Testament is about love. Well, no. Read Hosea 11. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? It was I that taught you to walk. I led you with cords of kindness. It's tender. It makes me tear up even when I recall it. It's the tenderness of God, the love of God, offsets some of that conquest of Canaan stuff. And in the New Testament, read the book of Revelation. I mean, those guys that wrote the Left Behind series, that is some gory, ugly stuff. And they got that from their reading of Revelation, as well as Daniel and some others, right? So this notion that the Old Testament's about law, the New Testament's about love, not true. The Old Testament's about wrath, New Testament's about love, not true. There are some differences, and we can talk about that when we get around to it. Because last year we talked about Israel, which is the hot-button topic, and we managed to have a great conversation for a couple months in our dialogue about that after a dozen of us came back. This year we talked about grace and forgiveness, and does forgiveness come before reconciliation or after? And some of us were listening very closely and we think we heard a bit of a difference there. But it's not nearly the stereotypical contrast that Christians sometimes attribute to Jews. And that's been one of the great blessings of the dialogue. Also, whenever I read texts, including from the book of John, the Gospel of John, and it talks about the Jews, I'm really conscious about that now. One of the rabbis said at our last dialogue, or one before that, the Gospel, especially John, talks about how the Jews killed Jesus like 70 times. I said, well, not quite. But the conversation about the Jews in the Gospel of John is probably 70, 80, 90-ish AD, when the synagogues are dividing up between Christian and still Jewish, and they're trying to sort out who are we, which is which, and there's this self-conscious separation between the Christian synagogues and the Jewish synagogues. And so talking about the Jews has a particular context. We try to explain that, and they go, okay. But don't forget the Crusades, and don't forget the Inquisition, and don't forget Martin Luther and the anti-Semitism at the center of the Protestant Reformation. So I've learned to read these texts with sensitivity now and be careful how we even say things like the Jews, because that's what the text says. But we try now to clarify, well, what that means. Of course, they're all Jews. Jesus is Jewish. All the disciples, everybody's Jewish. But in the Gospel of John, it's at a particular period where people are separating out who's Jewish and who's not as Christian. And we have to be careful to contextualize that, because our Jewish friends have suffered greatly when Christians haven't tried to do that. That was a long riff on your comment, Bob, but it doesn't take much for a preacher. It's an occupational hazard. Others, please, jump in. Please, Bobby. Yeah. I'm going to repeat just so you can hear. Bobby's asking, so what about the Jewish versus Christian views of evangelism and conversion? The rabbis that it's mostly, Mark Mahler from Temple Emmanuel, Alex Greenbaum from Bethel, and Howie Stein, who has a smaller congregation up north somewhere. These are the guys I know best, but I read a lot of this stuff. Jews would say, first of all, that Judaism has never been particularly interested in conversion because, that is to say, conversion to Judaism, because they believe that the God whom they worship is the God of all people. And God has a special covenant and relationship and salvation history with the Jews, yes. But the same God is the God who will ultimately redeem all people who want to be faithful to God. So, for example, they'll quote Genesis about Abraham, where God says to Abraham, through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. So they say, well, then God's got it covered. So we don't need to convert the goyim, that's us, because God will work something out with you. It's the same God, the same good and loving God. So there's no Jewish incentive to proselytize or have people convert to Judaism. If somebody wants to become a Jew, then there's a process to do that, and of course they will do it. So evangelism to Judaism isn't so much what we would think of as evangelism. Preach the good news and invite people to come to God in Christ, accept Christ as their Savior. They wouldn't do that, not because they don't want people to come to God, but because they recognize that God has relations with all kinds of people, and they think their job is to be a light to the world. We need to be faithful as Jews, faithful to the covenant, as a witness to, and I think there's a passage in Isaiah that talks about you are a light to the nations. Our job is to be faithful as Jewish people so that God can see, so people can see how God is good and what it looks like to try to be a faithful people, and then God will work that out with other people as God does. Does that make sense? Whereas in the opposite direction, of course, they're concerned about Jews converting to Christianity or any other religion. Again, not so much for theological reasons as for the preservation of the people. Please, Kim.
Would you say more about the anti-Semitism around the Reformation?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to say a little more about this next week when we talk about Muslims. But it's a different, I know, but... Martin Luther, central as he was to the Reformation, he had a dark side. He was initially, for example, supportive of the peasants in the peasants' uprising in 1525. And then he wrote a scathing letter justifying basically slaughtering the peasants who were rising up. I'm not prepared to quote, but I can look it up and bring them back next time. He said a lot of things about Jews as having essentially abandoned the covenant with God, and now Christians are taking that over. And there was a lot of sort of Jewish stereotyping that Martin Luther fed into, which some people say, this is a big complicated subject that I'm just not prepared to talk about today because I don't have the details in my head. But there are people who talk about, for example, World War II and the Nazis and the Holocaust, who will say that Lutheranism contributed to that in at least two ways. One is the Lutheran, and by that I mean Martin Luther himself, the Lutheran precedent of saying very harsh things about the Jews. And the second is that Luther had this notion of the two kingdoms, sort of a takeoff on Augustine's idea of the city of God and the city of man. But Luther had this theology of two kingdoms where he thought the church was the representative of the kingdom of God and the rulers, Caesar or the king or the president or whoever, is the representative of the kingdom of this world. And while those two things had some influence on each other, they were really distinct. And so Lutheranism argued, and this is an historical argument, I'm not competent to judge it, but the argument is that the Lutheran Church, very prominent in Germany along with Roman Catholicism, the Lutheran Church cultivated a mindset where there was a precedent for anti-Semitism in Luther himself, and this notion of the two kingdoms being separate meant that some Lutherans, at least, were inclined not to worry too much about what the state was doing, because that's not our concern. Our concern is the church, the kingdom of God. And so the argument is, and again, I'm not competent to judge it, the argument is that the Lutheran church in Germany looked the other way when Hitler and the Nazis were gaining their momentum because they had a theology that said this is not our problem. In contrast with the Catholic Church, this is also all this stuff is controversial. There's a big debate about the extent to which the Pope at the time and the Vatican ambassadors to Germany did or did not try to stand up to Hitler. One line of thought says the Pope and the Vatican were sort of complicit, way too acquiescent. Another line of thought says, well, no, actually, there was a good bit of resistance. And, of course, resistance was harder as the momentum of the Nazis got going. And that the Catholic Church, because it's inherently an international church, did a better job. They were both sorry. Protestants and Catholics were both awful in standing up to Hitler. But the Catholics arguably were less awful because it's the nature of Catholicism to be international. Whereas Protestants, this is an interesting observation, Protestant churches are often based in nationality and ethnicity. H. Richard Niebuhr, not Reinhold Niebuhr, but his brother Richard Niebuhr, wrote a book called The Social Sources of Denominationalism in the 1920s, where he said, yeah, of course, there are different denominations in Christendom because of different theologies, but also because of ethnicities. So why is Western Pennsylvania thick with Presbyterians? Because people with names like Galbraith and Gilchrist came from Scotland, moved to Western Pennsylvania. If they were lucky, they ran Carnegie's mills. More likely, they worked as laborers in Carnegie's mills. And that ethnic migration from Scotland is why Western Pennsylvania is thick with Presbyterians, because Scotland was Presbyterian. Go to the Midwest, and you know, if you listen to Prairie Home Companion, it's Minnesota Lutherans, right? Why? Because Swedes and Norwegians moved to the Midwest, and they were Lutheran. So this is, again, another riff. But the point being, there are people who say that it was the seeds in Lutheranism contributed to, and the anti-Semitism of that, contributed to the Lutheran Church being less effective than it might have been in standing up to Hitler. But there were lots of other things going on. Please, Barb.
One of the things that I see remarkably is how prone, for example, JCC in the Pittsburgh area stands up for the other. For example, reaching out to help refugees.
Yeah, yeah.
Very proud as a citizen in this area how far they go to put action, words into action.
Yeah.
And another thing, I read a book about Lebanon was being bombarded from both sides, and how if a person couldn't get to a hospital, if they were easier for them to go like 15 miles across over to get into Israel somehow,
yeah,
that the Israeli hospitals would treat them regardless of their religion and whether or not they could pay for anything, they were treated medically, given food and clothing.
Yeah.
They go so far way past what we sometimes consider normal.
So I hear Bob saying two things. First of all, many Jewish people in this country and elsewhere have a sensitivity for the other, capital O. And I think that's true, and it's for the obvious reason that Jews have been the other. So if you're accustomed to being picked on for who you are, you might have a sensitivity to racism, for example, or class issues or whatever. And I think that's true. Then she's going on to say that some Jews, and particularly in Israel, they've cared for people even if they were sort of on the other side medically and so forth. That's certainly true. What happens in these areas of conflict, of course, is that there's anecdotal stuff in both directions. Almost in any area of conflict, Northern Ireland, Israel, Palestine, Nigeria between Christians and Muslims, almost anywhere, you will hear of sort of heroic things done by one side and awful things done by the same side and vice versa. And that's all true. I mean, as they say in social science, the plural of anecdote is not data. There are people of goodwill in every community and there are vicious people in every community. And that's all true. Let me get some other people in. Please, Brad. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Brad's asking about financial success of Jewish people. Yeah. All the way back to Shakespeare, Shylock, right? Merchant of Venice. There is a stereotype of Jews as wealthy merchants. And in that capacity, often the object of resentment. By the way, I'm reading a whole book called The Age of Anger right now, written by a really brilliant Indian guy, talking about resentment as a major theme of the modern time. So Christians always have to be a little careful talking about this because there's this ugly, ugly history of pointing to Jews as the sort of rich merchants who secretly control stuff, the Jewish cabal, you know, behind everything. That was a big theme of the Nazis. And it comes up. Yeah, go to some of the alt-right stuff. I'll just say it. Go to some of the alt-right stuff. Go to some of these sort of fringe websites and so forth. And there's ugly stuff. I won't even repeat what is said, but there's a whole bunch of ugly anti-Semitic stuff around that theme. That said, however, it is probably objectively true that Jews have, on average, a higher income than many other people in this country, and that's because they tend to engage in professions like business and law, medicine. They tend to be very well educated. They have always valued education. If there's any stereotype that I don't mind making about Jews, it's that, in my experience, they're really bright people and responsible people in terms of working hard. And consequently, if you do that, you do well. The many Jews that I've talked to have said, well, yeah, I mean, the good side of that is we've been able to be successful, but also we've been sort of forced to be in commerce because of being uprooted from so many other societies. And again, I don't know historically how to judge that claim, but some have told me, well, look, you know, if you're not really welcome somewhere, and if you always have to be sort of on the move and open to relocating, then, of course, you develop connections everywhere, you become good at trade, and then you get to be involved in business and banking and so forth. So some of the big banking houses of Europe were run by Jews. And that's just objectively true. So, bottom line on that, I think, yeah, Jews by and large tend to be better educated, therefore they do well, they work hard, therefore they tend to be more prosperous, and that's partly just because of good old, what we might call Protestant work ethic. It's not just Protestants. And Christians have to be a little careful about that because that has always made Jews the object of resentment in some horrible ways, not least in Nazi Germany. Did you want to follow up?
Jim,
oh boy. Do you have a comment on that?
Come more out of our historic teaching with the laws against usury. I've heard that since Christians couldn't charge interest,
yeah,
the Jews became the bankers and the
lenders. Bob's suggesting that maybe that had to do partly with anti-usury laws in the Christian tradition. Muslims too, by the way. Muslims and Christians traditionally have had laws against usury, which is to say charging interest for borrowing money. Jews did not have that restraint. So Bob's saying one line of argument is, well, so Jews were able to lend money at interest, hence the Shylock character in Shakespeare. And so, of course, that gives you an advantage in commerce.
But that was also very useful to the Jews, to the Christians and the Muslims.
Yeah, sure.
They were doing our dirty work.
Sure. That's a really interesting question, Brad, about how much does that come out of a religious background. I'll just say what I know and the limits of what I know, and the latter is greater than the former. There is a whole thesis about the so-called Protestant work ethic. Because people ask, Max Weber and some others asked 100 and some years ago, how come capitalism took off most conspicuously in Western Europe and North America, and particularly in predominantly Protestant countries? It's an interesting sociological observation. And so Weber spun this whole theory. Weber was Jewish, by the way. Spun this whole theory about, well, has to do with Protestant theology and anxiety before God and looking for signs that you're actually among the elect in Calvinism. And so one sign of that is material prosperity. And so Protestants especially had this kind of theology that caused them to do well, be hardworking and so forth, Protestant ethic, but also took their prosperity as a sign of God's favor because they didn't have what the Catholics had, which was the absolution of the priest. And Weber spun a whole theory about that, which has been controversial ever since. I find it to be complicated. I think there are religious elements that feed those things, that feed how people do materially. But honestly, having been in churches for 40 years, I think people do what they do economically largely independent of, or sometimes in spite of, their religion, not because of it. I'm going to stop there. It's a big, complicated question. I don't have a good answer.
To me, there's another ingredient. I grew up in a town in Iowa. I had a lot of Jewish friends, a family, a lot of Jewish people. And the people I knew would not allow the Jewish businessman to fail.
To fail.
Control,
okay.
They would help.
Why?
Tradition. I came to see it as a virtue. They just wouldn't allow a businessman sliding downhill to fail. They prop him up, just keep the store open, keep a whole lot of
them. That's nice. Dan is saying that where he grew up, there were business people in his community, Christians, who would.
Jewish
people would not allow.
Would not allow
I see what you're saying.
Businesses.
All right. A kind of solidarity. That makes sense.
If
you have strong ethnic ties, I mean, that's true of other ethnic groups. Italians look out for each other, Poles look out for each other, Scots look out for each other.
Yeah, I think along with that, in at least my reading of the Old Testament, the Jewish people have a very communitarian sense.
Yeah.
It's not so, I think Protestants particularly are maybe more individualistic, but Jews, and to some extent Catholics, are more communitarian. I don't know how that fits in exactly.
That's a really good point, so I'll repeat what Bobby's saying. That Judaism is very much a sort of communitarian mindset, and that is related. So maybe this is partly an answer to Brad's comment or question. Judaism is very much a community affair. Catholicism is, to some extent, Protestantism least of all. So short riff on that. When we talk to Jews about how do you think about salvation, for example, because, you know, Christian stereotype is come to Jesus, right? The sort of stereotypical testimony, you know, my life was a mess, I was lying in the gutter, then somebody came and preached the gospel and Jesus saved me and I gave my life to Jesus and now my life's turned around. Sort of a Protestant individualistic Jesus saved me kind of testimony. It's all about Jesus reaching down to me. Judaism doesn't have that at all. The whole Old Testament is about God's relationship with the people of Israel. And so Jews find it sort of interesting and perhaps a little odd that Christianity, so especially Protestant Christianity, so often focuses on the individual. Whereas they would say, look, you know, our covenant before God is as a people. And so we're responsible to each other. And maybe that feeds the, so we have to lift each other up. But we're also collectively accountable. And the plot of the Old Testament, remember, is so God calls Abraham, all the nations of the world will be blessed through you. More specifically, later on, Moses, people of Israel get formed. And then there's that classic speech in Deuteronomy on the edge of the promised land. Behold, I set before you this day life and death. And on the life side is, you keep all the covenant and do the right stuff and God is pleased. On the death side is, you don't keep the covenant and God will abandon you. I mean, that's the speech. They go into the promised land and the whole story is they're not very good at keeping the covenant. And consequently, they get taken over by the Babylonians, go to exile for 70 years. That's the plot. So the whole kind of Jewish story is God has a covenant with us as a people, not exclusive. By the way, the notion of chosen people isn't that we are superior to others. That any Jew that I know would deny that. But rather, God has a covenant with us, and we are chosen for this purpose, to be faithful to this covenant. But it's between God and us as a people. And when we screw up as a people and are not faithful, bad stuff happens, like we get hauled off to Babylon. Protestant Christians so often devolve religion into sort of Jesus and me. And Catholics are somewhere in between, because Catholics have always been a bit more communitarian. The church as an institution, which is international, has said that the church as a body is the important thing. And yes, individuals are saved through it, but this whole sort of privatistic Protestant evangelical me and Jesus thing is completely alien to Judaism. So that's a good point. Please, Carol.
Yeah. So that's part of his explanation.
Yeah. Others, please, Bob.
You were talking about honor and government and all of that, and my mind is still going back to James and the place of that and the discussion about that. Some of what I'm hearing, again, from a Jewish perspective, feels more like a Jamesian approach, if you will. So
For sure. Yeah, and by the way, Martin Luther called the letter of James a right strawy epistle and thought it should be cut from the canon, which is back to the point that Carol was talking about a little bit ago. There is this strain in Lutheranism. Remember I put up 2 weeks ago, sola fide, sola gratia, sola scriptura, this big theme in Luther, saved by grace through faith and not by works. So anything that smelled like your good deeds will help you get to heaven, Luther wanted no part of them. Partly, that was Luther's psychology, right? Luther had issues. most people have issues, but Luther had some serious issues. I mean, he tried hard to please God. He really, really wanted to please God. And he was always messing up. He's a very passionate man in a lot of ways. And he's always messing up. So he's acutely aware of how no matter how hard he tried to be good, to do the right things, he couldn't please God. And finally, he got this sense of the grace of God. And so Luther was all about no reliance on works, it's all grace. But James, of course, says faith without works is dead, right? And the way to square that circle is there's no contradiction at all. Works follow necessarily as the fruits of faith. If you are, in fact, saved by grace through faith, works will follow as fruit grows out of a fruit tree. Even the letter to the Ephesians, you're saved by grace through faith, or Galatians, whichever. Galatians. You're saved by grace through faith for good works, right? So even Paul, who is a little Luther-like in that way, even Paul says you're saved in order to do the work. So, to this point, yeah, Judaism is big on mitzvah because they would say that that's how you know if you're being faithful to God, by the way you live. And much of the New Testament, Jesus says that, right? Matthew 25, when I was hungry, naked, sick, stranger in a prison. How Christians get away with this, just come to Jesus and don't care about the rest of the world, baffles me. Jesus himself says the criteria for who's a sheep and who's a goat, which is to say who goes to heaven and who goes to hell, isn't did you come to Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior. It's when I was naked, sick, stranger, in prison, hungry, what'd you do? Now, of course, in other parts of the Bible, yeah, I saved by grace through faith, I'm not saved by works. But this notion that is peculiar to a certain kind of evangelical Protestant Christianity, that what we do doesn't matter, all that matters is that you sort of get saved by Jesus, that's a profoundly unbiblical view. And in that respect, it's good for us to recover some of that Jewish insight about the importance of community. And the Catholics never did forsake that. And mainline Protestants did not either. It's only a certain segment of Protestantism that sort of boiled stuff down to personal relationship with Jesus. That's important, of course. But that's not the only thing. If you really have that, you'll do these other things. Others? Please.
I just wanted to share one thing. I'm a poor historian here on the story, but for people who might not realize, John Galbraith had taken time off, I think, in college days to bike through Europe in the early 40s with a Jewish friend.
Oh, wow.
And that could have been a bad idea. With what was brewing in the world, but it was,
wow,
I think, informative to him and a foundation as he saw what happens in the world in the absence of, huh, of faithful people.
Wow.
And it was very influential in his decision to go into the ministry.
Wow. You know, I never got to meet John. He died the beginning of the year when I came here. But I read his book, and I always liked him. And the more I learn about him, the cooler he gets. So thanks for sharing that. Any others? We got a comment or two, Steve?
Sorry if you're temporary, but since you're in a unique position with your colleagues and friends, what is their feelings on what's going to happen in Syria, and how does it affect them?
Going to happen in Syria? Well, what do you mean more specifically?
Well, how does it? They have to be. Your congregation has to be worried that this just the chaos that's happening in the Middle East right now, specifically in Syria, so close to them. The outcome of that could affect that Israel very seriously. So they have discussions about that openly.
Sure. I mean, we don't talk about Syria so much. We talk a little bit more about Palestine and kind of the immediate environment. But for sure, you know, Israel's the size of New Jersey, for goodness sake. And it's got these, it's surrounded by predominantly Arab nations and Iran, which is Persian, but also hostile. Yeah, they're concerned about all that. Israel became a nuclear nation sort of secretly, but it was a poorly kept secret, fairly early on. They view all this as existential for them, and it is. So if things really got out of hand in such a way that they were boiling over to directly affect the security of Israel, you can bet that Israel would be launching all sorts of incursions there. For the time being, they have been content to let mostly Russia now, and the United States to a lesser extent, try to keep a lid on that. But for them, it's existential. And that's something we have to remember. I mean, those of us who went to Israel and Palestine a year and a half ago, you know, we saw some stuff that we thought was really not just for the Palestinians. We're very sympathetic to that. And we disagree with our Jewish friends on some of our Jewish friends on some of that. But it's existential. If you live in a state the size of New Jersey and you're surrounded by hostile neighbors and they got some really scary weapons, and I mean, ISIL or ISIS or whatever you call it, that's a really bad outfit. That's just evil. I mean, next week we're going to talk about Islam. ISIL is not the center of Islam. Israel's, you can be sure that they've got all kinds of battle plans for what to do if that spills over. Also, by the way, this whole Iranian nuclear thing, we're out of time now. But for the United States, for Iran to have a nuclear weapon, that's a bad thing. For Israel, it's an existential thing. And if they ever get one, and it becomes obvious that they do, and the Middle East is in a state of peculiar anxiety, don't be surprised, you know, if Israel strikes. Because, again, it's existential for them.
They did in Iraq?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Obviously, we're just sort of romping through these big subjects. But if there was a sort of bottom line summary, it would just be what I said a few minutes ago. It's an important thing for the church to be a community that is part of God's reconciling work in the world. Part of that means relating to people of other faiths and relating to one another in love and friendship without ignoring our differences, but acknowledging them full well and knowing that what God wants most of all is love. Theology matters. We lift up Jesus. They don't. We get that. But the great commandment is not get an A on the theology exam. The great commandment is love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And Westminster needs to be part of that, and I'm grateful that Westminster has been from the get-go, because this guy, John Galbraith, took a bicycle trip across Europe and came back and started a place that cares about this stuff. And I'm grateful for that. All right, thank you all. See you next week for Muslims.